Chris is going to be in the situation.
Oh, I see.
If it's ever possible, you could start this with a sort of statement.
Yeah. Yeah.
Am I right in thinking that the Who stage show, the running order of the songs, was your responsibility? Well, how did that come about?
I think people were under the impression that the stage show was really my responsibility, but in actual fact, I only ever did the running order of the songs. Because there's an art in putting the songs together in a way that the overall picture becomes kind of a melody in itself.
So how did you go?
And but actually putting the stage show together, I mean, it really was the whole band. I mean, there's a lot more to the actual show side of it than just putting a bunch of songs together which form a show, you know. One of the biggest problems the Who had with getting a stage act right was we had so much material, and we were always working with two things. There was always a bunch of hardcore fans that wanted to hear more obscure, older stuff. We had the record companies which wanted us to promote the up-to-date album, so they had actually three things. And we also had an audience which were familiar with only the kind of Who stuff that they were hearing on the radio at the time, which might be some of the new record, but mostly would be the record before. So we had all these three things we were trying to accommodate. And it didn't pose much of a problem in the early days because we didn't have much material, but as it went on towards the 80s, it became a nightmare because you can, I mean, I think the 89 tour, we were playing 4.5 hours at one stage and still only doing a third of our catalogue. I mean, it was ridiculous.
Okay. You used to play guitar on stage with the Who in the early days. Why'd you give up?
I used to play guitar in the early, I used to be the lead guitarist. And I gave up because I was a sheet metal worker, and lead guitar playing and sheet metal work don't mix. My hands used to be literally covered in cuts. I took up the guitar a bit again in the latter tours, but I've lost the knack of playing and singing. I mean, it's something that left me, I'm afraid.
When did you start throwing the microphone around? Did
you practice it? Way back in, I think it was 1967, when we first went to America, and we kind of made our fame on my generation and the fact that we smashed up equipment, and which became, in a way, it became a real pain in the arse because people came to see us smash the equipment up and didn't listen to the music. But I used to feel so kind of vulnerable with just this silly thing on the lead and just standing there. And I mean, and Jagger was the best dancer in the world. And all the other people were cool guitarists. You know, they had a nice guitar, they could look trendy, and drummers had everything to play with. But a singer's only got in, like, his physical presence and this silly thing on a lead. And I used to smash it about on the drums, the microphone, and that got a bit boring. You know, where could that go? Nowhere further. And one day I threw it, and it headed. From what I remember, I think I threw it and it was aiming towards either Pete or Keith, and I stopped it from going with the other hand, and it came back to me, and I mean, no one was more shocked than me, and I thought, wow, that's a good effect. Work, but I never ever practiced it off the stage. I only ever did it in a show, so it kind of grew organically, but it came out of boredom.
Yeah. Did you always play very loud, and why were you so loud?
The volume thing came from, I suppose, I mean, the origins of rock and roll. I mean, it was always, I mean, the first things you ever read about rock and roll, loud, you know, in-your-face music. And in the early days, we could never afford very, very good equipment. So to compensate for being loud, we used to play with what we then called drive. We used to kind of really play hard and drive. But then as we got more money, we bought bigger and bigger equipment, and it got incredibly loud. Whether it got better or not, I don't know. Singers had a hard time in those days because there was no monitors. So I sang for 20 years on the... Oh, no, not, maybe not 20, 15 years on the stage. And I may have heard 5% of the gigs we played. The rest was just like playing to the noise of a Concorde engine. When you're that close to the speakers, that's what it was like. In the middle, because, you know, a guitarist can just turn up if he can't hear what he's doing. If the bass player's too loud, he just turns up thing. You know, but when you're stuck in front of the whole caboodle, it was fun days. You needed to be a brute, and I was a brute. Yeah.
Did you think everybody else was playing too loud for you to sing over?
Oh, it was a constant rouse. Well, mainly because, you know, the problem with singing is, as well, is that the ear, I don't know anyone really who likes their own voice, the sound of their own voice, and so there's something to do with your own ear doesn't pick up certain resonances that your voice actually gives. And then when you can't hear your voice, I think this is why deaf people have so much problem in speaking, when you can't actually hear your own voice, you try and, subconsciously, you're trying to... add things that are there already, so you kind of overcompensate. So immediately your voice gives out because you're trying too hard.
You think there was competition on stage as to who could attract the audience's attention?
Oh, the Who was built on competition. I mean, the competition was horrendous on and off the stage. I mean, we were all complete show-offs. I mean, even John in his funny way, I mean, he worked on the art of doing nothing till people used to think he was asleep, apart from his fingers and the noise that was coming out of him. But, I mean, John is quite an interesting character because off stage, he's probably the most eccentric guy of the lot. I mean, I think he's probably even more eccentric than Keith Moon. That's what... John is a real enigma.
What was your reaction? You've touched on this slightly before, but I'll ask it anyway. What was your reaction when Pete and then Keith started smashing their equipment?
I must admit that the first time he did it, it pissed me off. Mainly because I'd struggled so hard to buy my first guitar. I mean, my parents had to mortgage the house to get my first guitar. And the ones before that, I actually bought planks of wood and I made them with my own hands. And to see a guy just get hold of something which was so precious to me and smash it to smithereens, I used to get kind of angry. But then, you know, then I could kind of see that they are just planks of wood with strings on. Some of them are very beautiful, but I mean, it's only material rubbish, you know.
Can you recall playing the Marquee in 1965, the regular Tuesday night shows? Any stories from that era?
The only thing I remember about I remember playing there quite well, the Marquee. The Marquee was... We took it over on a Tuesday night, and Kit Lambert and Chris Stamp had all these free tickets printed for the first night. And the previous Tuesday to our opening at the Marquee, we went out on the streets of London, of the West End, with a bunch of our fans, to attempt to give these free tickets away. And we found difficulty giving the bloody things away. Then we suddenly realised why Tuesday nights had been so dead at the Marquee. I mean, there was just nobody about in the West End on a Tuesday night. So we actually went into doing the Marquee with quite a bit of intrepidation, because it was a notoriously quiet night in the West End. But it didn't stay quiet for long.
It seemed that when you went into Europe, you spent quite a bit of time touring around Scandinavia, Sweden up there. Any reason why you picked on that particular part of the world?
We used to tour Sweden and Denmark and that, yeah, because the women were so beautiful. But we soon found out they're also very boring.
Can you recall the Monterey Festival show? Any stories from that?
Monterey was a big one for us. I mean, before we even got to Monterey, Monterey was built up in my imagination as an enormous event. And I must admit, at Monterey, I was incredibly stoned. We all were. I mean, I think that goes without saying that we all were incredibly stoned. And a very good friend of mine from San Francisco had just made a new drug called STP, which was a derivative of marijuana and LSD, some strange kind of concoction. And we'd all, well, I'd sampled it at least, so, I mean, my memories of Monterey are a little bit vivid, to say the least. But my main recollection of Monterey was something that happened not on the stage, but underneath it. There was probably the best jam session I've ever heard in my life happened on the stage, underneath the stage, because the dressing room was under the stage. And there was Jimi Hendrix, Brian Jones of the Stones, Pete, who else, George Harrison. I think George Harrison was there. I think Eric Clapton was there. Mama Cass. Oh, so many people, yeah, all just singing and playing. And it was amazing. I've always wished that the bloody recording equipment was under the stage rather than on it.
What about the tour that followed with Herman's Hermits? The Who were actually supporting Herman's Hermits, which sounds crazy now, but probably wasn't quite so crazy at the time.
The Herman's Hermits tour was I don't know. I mean, we all felt a bit strange about that. I mean, I particularly felt that we shouldn't have been doing it. But there again, we needed a platform to get to people, and somebody convinced us that Herman was the right platform. Who was that somebody? I've tried to find him ever since. But it was good. It was good fun, and what can I say about it? I mean, what I'm proud of after this amount of time's gone past is that we were probably the first, one of the few, I think we were probably the first English band to break America by touring. All the other bands before, like the Stones and the Beatles, the Dave Clark Five, I mean, can you believe it? They had huge success over there, but it all came from huge record success, and then they went over and toured. The Who did it the other way around. And so, I mean, whatever you say about the Herman's tour, whether it was right for the Who to be playing with Herman's Hermits, it did us a lot of good in the fact that it got us out there and people became aware of this band that was always working, always working. And that's how we broke America, so that, it was good in that way.
We've got some footage from Tanglewood, which is about 1969-70. But by this time, you'd really changed your image, Roger. You had long, curly hair, fringe jacket, tight blue jeans, bare chest a lot of the time. Was this a conscious thing on your part? Because this image became a sort of archetypal rock idol look, and it's an image that a lot of other people copied, you know? How did you come by this image? Was it just your idea?
Well, I was... I mean, the image I kind of ended up with in the 70s, first of all, started from me getting fed up with using dippity-doo to straighten my hair. So, I mean, I was lumbered with that in the 60s because, I mean, worse than being someone with, you know, with the worst disease in the world, which was contagious, even worse than that was to be a mod with curly hair. So I used to use this dippity-doo to straighten my hair, with some hilarious results. And in the late 60s, I really got fed up with this and threw the stuff along with the hairdryer out of the window and just let the curls come, you know. And kind of as it got longer, it got more interesting. I thought, oh, well, that's the end of going to the hairdresser ever again. You know, I really had enough of playing with my hair for years. So I just let it grow. And that, that kind of got movement in the head, which you suddenly feel things moving on your body, and it creates another movement. It's very kind of chaos theory. But also at that time, my microphone twirling was all developing all at the same time, and the more that developed, the more I needed to be free of clothes, and I could go and buy shirts off the you know, I have shirts made and all normal clothes, t-shirts and all that, but very, you know, within three songs they were soaking wet and incredibly restrictive to wear. So I thought, I've got to get around this. What's the best thing to use? So I got into using pigskin. It was hide, natural hide. And it was just like wearing another skin, and no matter how much you sweated, or it just went with you, and it all developed from there. The fringes on the jacket came from, again, the feeling of the hair moving. I thought, well, if that moved, let's get something else that's moving. And it just developed, and along with, you know, what was going on in America at the time, the hippie thing, they started wearing a few fringes, and I just developed it further.
By this time, Tommy had become the predominant section of the stage actor. Do you think, in a sense, you became Tommy on stage, in the eyes of the audience? The film perhaps reinforced this idea.
I think there was. It was impossible for me not to become Tommy to the audience. I mean, absolutely impossible, because I mean, in those days, I used to sing the whole thing. And obviously, when I did the film, people found it very difficult to disassociate me with Tommy. I still get problems with that today. I mean, I still live with that today. I'm still very proud of it, and I don't really give a toss if people like it or not. I mean, I had a good time doing it.
I was going to say, how did Tommy change your life?
It paid the rent.
Tommy paid the rent,
it's true. Before, I mean, that's really true. Before Tommy, we were flat broke, penniless, and in debt to the tune of what would be today millions and millions of pounds. And Tommy paid the rent. But it obviously had other effects, but I mean, that gets all too serious, doesn't it?
Yeah, okay. We've got some footage from the Isle of Wight, the 1970 Isle of Wight show. Since that was one of the best British shows in the Who's career. Can you remember that at all? Any stories from that?
The Isle of Wight.
The last Isle of Wight.
Yeah, the last Isle of Wight. Yeah. Again, I remember the shows. I think we went on the Isle of Wight. We went on after Emerson, Lake and Palmer. And they were quite a big group. They were a huge group then, and they were a difficult act to follow. But again, the kind of things I remember about the Isle of Wight is what was going on off the stage before the show. And the Who were blessed with a group of very kind of intrepid roadies. And it was very cold backstage, and we were all living at kind of campfires. And everybody else had run out of firewood, except the Who's roadies were going stealing the outside fence to put on our fire. So we had the biggest fire in the place. And I remember spending most of the evening before we went on stage with Jim. It was the kind of last time I saw Jim Morrison. And we drank, I think it was three quarters of a bottle of, we were drinking Southern Comfort in those days. And I think if you look at the film, I think Jim went on after us, didn't he? And that's the last time I saw him. So that's my main recollections of the Isle of Wight. The show I always remember as being a good show, but you know, we did so many good shows.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, by this time...
He's back! He didn't have a very long lunch break, did he?
Can you recall the time that Keith collapsed?
Sorry,
sorry.
Can I describe it, Steve? Yeah. All right, Chris.
Can you recall the time that Keith collapsed while he was playing that show in San Francisco?
The time Keith collapsed at the Cow Palace, we were just about to premiere Quadrophenia in the States. And all I remember of the actual incident was that Can't Explain started out quite erratic. Substitute went from being very fast to non-existent, and our drummer had passed out completely. And two songs into a show, this is a big problem when you've got kind of 14,000 screaming fans out front. And I think it was me, I think just said, is there a drummer in the audience? And a queue of drummers formed up at the entrance to the stage, and we chose one. And I think, how long we played for or what it was like, but I remember we did quite an extensive part of our old repertoire. Quadrophenia, of course, had to go out the window with this kid from the audience. And it took Moon a week to recover from that one.
When you did Quadrophenia live, there were all sorts of problems with syncing the on-stage sound with the tapes. What do you feel about any stories about that?
The biggest problem we had with Quadrophenia was working with... In those days, we didn't have... The synthesizers were very, very... in their very, very early stages. And the technology was non-existent to kind of carry that thing around to put it on stage. We experimented working with quadraphonic sound, which was interesting but not very successful. But the main difficulty was working with tapes of the synthesized music, because we... go away! There's someone digging their way in here, excuse me. We would... To work with tapes on the Quadrophenia sections really did limit the show, because once the tape was started, you were stuck into playing within that envelope. And previous to that, The Who had always been very, very much a free-form band. It's almost jazzy in a way. I mean, things would literally grow block by block. But once you started that tape, you had to play with that tape until it finished, and then you could do what you liked, if you still had any brain left. And it was a really big problem, and it was a big problem for me, because from where I stood on the stage, I could never hear the damn tape anyway. It was all even Keith had to wear earphones. It was a nightmare.
Can you recall anything about the 1974 Charlton show? We've got footage of that one, you see.
Is that the one where it rained? No, it was a later one, wasn't it? Yeah. No, I can't really remember much about the Charlton show.
During the song Who Are You, you used to run on the spot for several minutes. In fact, you virtually sprinted. Was that your idea? How did that come about?
It came about really... I was really tongue-in-cheek... talking to America, because every time I used to go to America, I never ceased to be amazed. I better say that, I better preempt that for you. The running in Who Are You really came out of me never ceasing to be amazed at how many Americans actually do jog. And I used to, because in England, nobody walks very fast, let alone jogs. And every time I used to go out to America, there'd be all these people, 7 o'clock in the morning. And I used to think, well, who the fuck are you?
Which was the hardest Who song to sing on stage?
I think to say that there's one particular difficult Who song for me to sing would be ridiculous. They're all difficult for me to sing. It's more of an acting job than a singer's job, really. So they're all characters to actually put onto yourself. I mean, unless you put the whole character on, the song doesn't live. You know, it's just kind of weird. That's why I suppose I can go on doing it for so long and still enjoy it. If it was just a song, I'd probably be bored to tears with it 25 years ago.
When Keith died and Kenny Jones took over, how did that change it for you as far as the live show was concerned?
Oh, we're diplomatic here. Not my strong point.
Not libelous, please.
Not libelous. Well, when Keith died, I mean, it was... I don't know how to ask. Can I skip this question? I mean, I don't know how to. I mean, I never ever wanted to replace Keith with a permanent drummer. I thought Keith was such an extraordinary drummer, and I was aware that our sound was so tied up in a style that linked Pete's kind of very rhythmic banjo type guitar playing some of the time with his kind of sparse lead playing, which could often leave a big hole, to John's bass playing, which again, John doesn't play like a normal bass player. He plays almost 10 times as much. It's almost as though we do need a real bass player as well, you know. And Keith's drumming, to me, it was always obvious that the drumming was the cement that linked these two bricks together. And when he died, I never ever wanted to replace him with another drummer because I could see the problems we were going to have. And Kenny Jones, bless him, I mean, he's a great drummer. But to try and fill that seat is impossible. It was like putting the wheel of a Cadillac on a Rolls Royce. No, it's a wonderful wheel, fit on a Rolls, you know. And I think we proved that point. I think my point was proved when Simon Phillips played on the 89 tour, who played much more like, who actually did manage to emulate what Keith played much more faithfully. And then the music, we had a percussionist as well on those tour. But you know, you could really feel the music all join up then. I think for me, when Kenny was playing, it was like, it, nothing gelled. It was, it, oh, used to make me.
And anything else, Nick, you think I haven't touched on? I've really gone through the questions. I mean, we talked.
What time is it?
10:01.
Oh.
I mean, as you said, the importance of the stage. Roger touched on that anyway. I mean, you mentioned earlier, maybe we could go through it again, about how important the stage was to The Who, because you were one of the first, if not the first, band that made their name and reputation through the live show as opposed to selling records.
Yeah, it is.
You know. How did you get so good, though? Was it just playing so often?
I think The Who always were a live band. I don't think The Who, and I still don't feel that The Who ever really got it right on record. I really don't think that. There's something about The Who's sound. It's kind of bigger. It's bigger than any of us individually. And when we get together and make the noise that we make, it grows into something which is more than sound. And it's not just a circus show. There's some kind of chemistry that goes on. I don't know what it is. And then there's an energy. And I really do honestly feel that we've never ever captured it properly on record. And the stage always accommodated it. It always gave us what we needed. It was always there on stage. It never was there on record. Thanks very much to the stage.
Okay.
All right, I've got to go. I've had enough.